I thought I would read from some of his English writings. First, let's chant his Pranam Mantra. Say it to me. Namo Bhakti Vinodaya.
Namo Bhakti Vinodaya.
Satchitananda Namine.
Satchitananda Namine.
Gaura Shakti Swarupaya.
Gaura Shakti Swarupaya.
Rupa Nuga Varayate.
Rupa Nuga Varayate.
In the meaning of this, from my obeisances to Bhakti Vinod. Satchitananda Namine. His name is Satchitananda. Gaura Shakti Swarupani. He is the Swarup, you could say the personification of the potency of Lord Chaitanya, Gaura Shakti Swarupani. Rupa Nuga Varayate. To the best, or the best of the, not Gaura, the best of the followers of Rupa Goswami. So, just a little bit, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was born on September 2nd, 1838. About the same year, either that year or the year after, Queen Victoria, Victoria became Queen of England, she was coronated. And he passed away in 1914. Beginning of what we call World War I. He was born in the country, in Ula, on the Bhagirath River. Kayastha family was his mother's home. He was there. Also that year he was born the first British Afghan war. It's still going on. And Oliver Twist became a bestseller in England. When he was 11 years old, his father died of cholera. And he was a cholera academic several times. Whereas he went to study in Calcutta with his maternal uncle, who was named Kashi Prasad Ghosh, who was a poet. And at that time, there were in Calcutta a whole coterie of modernized Bengali intellectuals. They were called Bundralok. Kali Prasad Ghosh was a very prominent member of this Bundralok. He edited an English language periodical called the Hindu Intelligencer, part of this organization called Young Bengal. These are all modernizing intellectuals. So then he lived there for a while. Studied at a Hindu charitable institution. Sometimes he'd go back to his village. And sometime in 53 or 54, he became his maternal family. They were Shaktas, worshippers of Durga. His father's side was Vaishnava, but he was even born and sort of brought up on his mother's side. But when he went back, he got the association of some Vaishnavas, Kartavajas actually, later on listed as by them as deviants. But that time he got some Vaishnava association. And then but he continues his education with these people, when he was 19 or so, his whole village was destroyed by the Ula, destroyed by cholera. And company, he became a total orphan. And he moved in with the Tagore family, like Rabindranath Tagore, they're part of this thing. So Dujendranath was his friend. And he studies, Mahaprabhu studies European philosophy and Brahmo Samaj that was in at that time. And also he came under the influence of Unitarian, these are American types now. In the beginning of the Bhagavad, he mentions Emerson, Channing, Newman, Unitarian. These are modernizing Christians in America at this time. So then his paternal grandfather, he gets married, finding good work, goes to Orissa. He is working in various kinds of, as a school teacher and so forth in Orissa. Anyway, I won't get into the whole thing. His wife died, his wife got remarried. He had a son that was 10 months old, so he got remarried. That's when my Bhagavat gave a father of the mother Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. So finally he enters government service, where he finally turned, say, 28 years, retired in 1892. While he was down in Puri, in various things, he came into more contact with Vaishnavism. And somewhere along the line, he finds that he was able to reach Chaitanya Charitamrita. He said, and this is from his autobiography, he said, "My first reading of Chaitanya Charitamrita created some faith in Chaitanya. On the second reading, I understood that Chaitanya was unequaled. But I doubted how such a good scholar with so high a level of prema could recommend the worship of Krishna, who had such a questionable character." So he talked to all these Christian missionaries, and they were always putting down Hinduism as low level. I was amazed, and I thought about this in detail. Afterwards, I humbly pray to God, "O Lord, please give me some understanding to know the secret of the matter. The mercy of God is without limit," and so I soon understood. From then on, I believed that Chaitanya was God. I often spoke with many Vairagis who understand Vaishnava Dharma. From childhood, the seed of faith in Vaishnava Dharma had been planted within my heart, and now they had sprouted. I experienced anuraga. And day and night, I read and thought about Krishna. That's what he says. Interestingly enough, at one point he gets transferred to Dijnapur. Dijnapur is in North Bengal. He was a deputy magistrate, and in Dijnapur there was a large, very active Vaishnava community. Because when he entered in government service, first he was in Bihar and in Dijnapur, and there he got the Chaitanya Charitamrita and Srimad Bhagavatam. And very quickly, he's about 30 years old now. And this is where he delivers in English this lecture, the Bhagavad, its philosophy, ethics, and theology. And here's a person very quickly. And then he goes to Puri and becomes a a deputy magistrate there and studies Vaishnava in Sanskrit with the pundits. He actually didn't take initiation until he was 42 years old, 1980, from Bipin Bihari Goswami. He and his wife both were teaching him Bipin Bihari. Anyway, we know there are a lot of people, Victorians, you know, had so much energy, traveling all the time, walking everywhere, just that. So he kept on this career, gets further and further into Krishna consciousness. He starts publishing, finally he arranges to get transferred to near Mayapur. And he gets involved in restoring the birthplace of Mahaprabhu, going back and forth there in Calcutta, and this big preaching movement all over in Calcutta and Bengal, and so on. And so for him, he saw two things. One, that Lord Chaitanya's, the Vaishnavism taught by Lord Chaitanya was superior to anything he had ever seen before. That was the truth. It was better than Christianity and anything else, and he saw it as something that the whole world needed to have. And he was the architect of really everybody coming to the West. But he was exposed to the West and even American things very early on. I want to read a little bit. You know, he famously envisioned it. People would come to Mayapur from all countries and chant together. Here's something that he wrote. In religious literature, this is called apologetics. This is something he wrote in 1899, called The Hindu Idols. This is published in by the Tract Society of Calcutta, January 1899, and it's a response to Professor Max Müller on Durga. Max Müller was a big Indologist, published the sacred books of the East and all that other stuff, and had written something which I haven't seen, critical of Durga. So this is his response, and they say these are Durga, Shiva, these are non-Vedic gods. And he makes a whole case that they're Vedic and all those other stuff. But I want to get to read something in the middle. He says, but far from studying these things properly, you have come forward with such an uncharitable remark. I'll say I'm in the middle of this article now. I'm skipping all the stuff. Against the Divine Mother as, quote, she is the patron deity of dacoits, thugs, and murderers. Because there was a thuggy cult. He said they were, you know, killing people as a sacrifice to Kali. And there are several methods of reducing the population. Men say, reverend gentlemen, that gold, if trodden underfoot, does not lose its value. If this is true, and if Hinduism has any truth in it, it is impossible for you to discredit it by any act of violence. But an act that does injustice to Hinduism and speaks ill of any other religion too, I will properly show, is by nature subject to universal reproach. You are no doubt profound thinkers and have at last found out Durga and have at last found out Durga to be the cause of Indian dacoits and murderers. Does it not behoove you in the same manner to ascertain the cause of wars, revolutions, and massacres in the Christian world? You ascribe them to political motives. But what politics? What can politics be but religion in another form? Is it possible for a man to be one in religion and another in politics? Do you mean to say that Raskia was otherwise a good man? You know the famous architect of the French Revolution, Robespierre, but only found by political motives to send almost hourly presents to an incessant guillotine? Condemn, if you like, Robespierre and other such of the French Revolution as mere non-Christian demagogues. But in what way are you to account for the conduct of the clergy, 148 in number, who joined in the Tiers Etat in the Church of St. Louis and upheld the cause of a fierce party, most of whom sought to distinguish themselves by public convulsions or dichotomies of the most fearful magnitude? Was not this great reinforcement headed again by such worthy persons as the Archbishop of Vienna and Bordeaux? Were not these model peacemakers beginning the revolution with a redoubled vigor at a time when, as a popular tumult, it might possibly come to an end? What was the origin of the famous Rights of Man that preached the universal equality of mankind and proceeded, after all, to save many at the sacrifice of a few, when it had the secret strength of destroying the whole? Anyway, it goes on and on like this. I therefore ask you, Reverend gentlemen, if Durga is the cause of Indian murders, what, in your opinion, was the cause of the French Revolution? That horrible Saint Bartholomew, that was another massacre earlier of Protestants, of 1 million of human souls at the very center of the Christian world. You say famine. Was not India ever visited by severe famine than France in 1789? And yet how many revolutions has she recorded on that account? You say privileges of the upper class. But what privileges did not the Brahmins of India enjoy in ancient times and so on? He has a great deal of knowledge of the French politics at that time. Huh? Another moment then followed, the National Assembly having confiscated the land of the church to mete out the exigencies of the state. Far from sacrificing their own interests, the clergy now dispersed all over France, addressed the sons of ignorance to rise against their rulers, and soon the fearful body were in motion, followed, and as soon as the fearful body were in motion, that is the mob, followed them with shouts, as it were, "Go in, friend, go on, the kingdom of heaven is near at hand," and so on. He says, then he goes on, "You say, thus also can the holy zeal, righteous indignations of the Muslims, Muslim and Christians, and their iconoclastic practices be intelligible." And again, this is somewhere, he's quoting from some statements they wrote. "You say, thus also can the holy zeal, righteous indignation of Muslims and Christians and their iconoclastic practices become intelligible," that is, destroying images. And again, "Oh, for 1,000 Bengali young men to rise up in their manhood and put down all idolatry, the curse of their nation." Is it, Reverend gentlemen, that if the government did not interfere, you should have broken down our idols and favored us with a grand St. Paul on the dilapidated house of Jagannath? Perhaps not, for you are our well wishers. It is not perhaps your disappointment, but our laxity that makes you invoke the spirit of Sultan Mahmud, although it is a fact the world is not going to see again what is a scene of yore. Far from taking your remark in a hostile light, I rather regard you as a doctor wishing to cure the present disease condition of our religious institutions. But should you be like a doctor, that being unable to find out the real cause of the disease, makes an immediate arrangement for vivisection? Totally dismembering the patients. As regards the 1,000 Bengali young men to whom you have appealed, I regret to say that my humble self is one of them. The light of Christianity. To do you justice, reverend gentlemen, it is your light that has illuminated what was dark. You educated me when I was young and asked me even if I were needy. You facilitated the study of the sacred books, where your tracts again made me dive into a little more than a Christian depth. It is your light that discovers mid the moldering heaps of our ancient shrines a stupendous monument which thousands of summer suns rose up in vain to heat. The blasts of foreign conquest strove in vain to shape, and the most violent of iconoclasts sought in vain to demolish. A grand convention, all liberating, but granting freedom only when it suits, all embracing, but sternly denouncing one that betrays, all compliant except what does not comply with its unaccountable dogma of God is everything, and all discussing but avoiding anything sensational, and thus repelling by its keen insight and sober judgment the cause of an impending revolution, a liberal institution, showering on man honors and addressing, when in the embryo, and addresses, showering honors and addresses when in the embryo, and continuing to do so until a few hundred years have elapsed after his death, solacing him in all the sad turmoils of this world, and preparing him for the one to come, and resolutely intent to stand by him to the last. A holy temple with an ocean of significance in it, now performing great sacrifices, now absorbed in deep meditation, now living in austere woods, now singing and shouting in the streets, now casting flowers to the straw and clay of its own making, directing, as it were, all its energies to reach a certain point of eternal rest, now calling an idol a father, a son, a brother, a friend, now calling another a mother, a daughter, a sister, developing, as it were, all earthly ties and affections into one unspeakable relationship with the supposed kin of man. To do you justice, reverend gentlemen, you are our superior in all other respects, but in religion only our equal. And so are our Islam brothers. You say you profess a religion that excels all others, but such excellence as your religion boasts of belonged to the Hindus long before the birth of Christ. The mysterious advent of Christ they have known. I see. The mysterious advent of Christ they had known of Krishna. His austere morals they had realized in Buddha. His devotion and persecution they had witnessed in Prahlad, while his mournful departure they had conceived in Sati, they mean the Hindus. Everything that his the mysterious advent of Christ, they, the Hindus, had known in Krishna. His austere morals they had realized in Buddha. His devotion and persecution they had witnessed in Prahlad, while his mournful departure they had conceived in Sati. Like Krishna, he was born under the vigilant sword of a Kamsa in Herod. Like that of Buddha, his public ministry was to be preceded by a life of seclusion at an Urubiwala, in the walled retreat of Nazareth. Like Prahlad, he had to be brought before a gigantic daitya meeting in the Sanhedrin and persecuted there without mercy, and like Sati, he had to plead the purity and even the superiority of poverty before an arrogant royalty which only could end in sensational tragedy. Whether the evangelist borrowed these ideas from the Hindus to engraft them eventually on one of the many sacrifices the Jews had made to the Romans, or there was really such a Christ born in whom so many conflicting ideas could have harmoniously existed, matters very little indeed. It is enough that the Hindus possessed them in common with their Western brothers in as much as one that salutes the four cannot but salute Christ, and one that reveres Christ can by no means disregard the four. You boast of your martyrdom, reverend gentlemen, but read history, and you will see that our blood also fell upon our idols. You will see the Brahmins dying with their idols at their bosom at Somnath, Kanaj, and Benares. But our prosecutors are very sincere indeed. Though they brought with them one true God, they were not free from the ideal of a hostile Satan, which made them destroy everything that fell in their way. In India, however, in this land of Ekam Eva Advitiyam, one only, no second, nothing else, Ekam Eva Advitiyam, definition of Brahman, but besides which there is no second thing, they soon gave up this inimical idea and held, and then he has something in Urdu, I think, that everything, either good or bad, is created by God alone. And as soon as they got that idea, the Muslims, in the shape of pious fakirs, spread all over India to preach the new doctrine from village to village and from door to door, which they are doing till this day. Unless he's some apologetics. That's what it says here, yeah. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, this is a compilation of English writings. So you can see his style. This is the Bhagavat. Maybe you read that one. This he delivered, in Dishanapur before a gathering of educated people in English. And I suspect in the 19th century a person delivered a lecture that was famous, then they went everywhere and delivered the same lecture. Read it. There was no other, people would do that all the time. So I'm sure this was good in many, many other places, but the first one was in Dinajpur. He begins with a quotation from Bhagavatam 1.1.3. O ye who are deeply merged in the knowledge of the love of God, and also in deep thought about it, constantly drink, even after your emancipation the most tasteful juice of the Srimad Bhagavatam, come on earth through Sri Shukadeva Goswami's mouth, carrying the liquid nectar out of the fallen and, as such, very ripe fruit of the Vedic tree which supplies all with their desired objects. So he begins, we love to read a book which we've never read before. We are anxious to gather whatever information is contained in it, and with such acquirements, our curiosity stops. This mode of study prevails amongst a great number of readers who are great men in their own estimation as well as in the estimation of those who are of their own stamp. In fact, most readers are mere repositories of facts and statements made by other people. But this is not study. The student is to read the facts with a view to create, and not with the object of fruitless retention. Students, like satellites, should reflect whatever light they receive from authors and not imprison the facts and thoughts just as magistrates imprison the convicts in a jail. Thought is progressive. The author's thought must have progress in the reader in the shape of correction or development. He is the best critic who can show the further development of an old thought, but a near denouncer is the enemy of progress and consequently of nature. It's such a 19th century progress. It was like so much in the air then. Begin anew, says the critic, because the old masonry does not answer to at present. Let the old authors be buried because his time is gone. These are shallow expressions. Progress certainly is the law of nature. And there must be correction and developments with the progress of time. But progress means going further or rising higher. Now if we are to follow our foolish critic, we are to go back to our former terminus and make a new race. And when we have run half the race, another critic of this stamp will cry out, begin anew, because the wrong road has been taken. And this way our stupid critic will never allow us to go over the whole road and see what is the other terminus. Thus the shallow critic and the fruitless reader are the two great enemies of progress. We must shun them. The true critic, on the other hand, advises us to preserve what we have already obtained, and to adjust our race from that point where we have arrived in the heat of our progress. He will never advise us to go back to the point whence we started, as he fully knows that in that case there will be a fruitless loss of our valuable time and labor. He will direct the adjustment of the angle of the race at the point where we are. This is also the characteristic of the useful student. He will read an old author and will find out his exact position in the progress of thought. He will never propose to burn the book on the ground that it contains thoughts which are useless. No thought is useless. Thoughts are means by which we attain our objects. The reader who denounces a bad thought does not know that a bad road is even capable of improvement and conversion into a good one. One thought is a road leading to another. Thus the reader will find that one thought, which is the object today, will be the means of a further object tomorrow. Thoughts will necessarily continue to be an endless series of means and objects in the progress of humanity. The great reformers will always assert that they have come not to destroy the old law, but to fulfill it. Jesus Christ. Valmiki, Vyas, Plato, Jesus, Mohammed, Confucius, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu assert the fact either expressly or by their conduct. You see how he's taking very clear, like a modernized intellectual Indian audience, speaking to them in English, and like right away giving homage to the, you know, this reigning 19th century doctrine of progress. he's going to, and you have to understand that the Bhagavatam, he'll mention that how the Bhagavatam was rejected as, you know, a weird, Gothic nonsense. Here it goes on. The Bhagavata, like all religious works and philosophical performances and writings of great men, has suffered from the imprudent conduct of useless readers and stupid critics. The former have done so much injury to the work that they have surpassed the latter in their evil consequence. Men of brilliant thought have passed by the work in the quest of truth and philosophy, but the prejudice which they imbibed from its useless readers and their conduct prevented them from making a candid investigation. Not to say of other people, the great genius of Raj Ram Mohan Roy, the founder of the sect of Brahmoism, that's the Brahma Samaj, which was a kind of converting of Hinduism into Unitarian Christianity, getting rid of worship of deities and so on. The Bengali thing in Bhagavad Gita was exposed to it. It was like the elite, you know, the latest thing. He did not think it worth his while to study this ornament of the religious library. He crossed the gate of the Vedanta as set up by the Mayavada construction of the designing Shankaracharya, the chosen enemy of the Jains, and chalked his way out to the Unitarian form of the Christian faith converted into an Indian appearance. Ram Mohan Roy was an able man. He could not be satisfied with the theory of illusion contained in the Mayavada philosophy of Shankara. His heart was full of love to nature. He saw through the eyes of his mind that he could not believe in his identity with God. He ran furiously from the bounds of Shankara to those of the Quran. There even he was not satisfied. He then studied the preeminently beautiful precepts and history of Jesus, first in the English translation and at last in the original Greek, and took shelter on the holy banners of the Jewish reformer. But Ram Mohan Roy was also a patriot. He wanted to reform his country in the same way as he reformed himself. He knew it fully that truth does not belong exclusively to any individual man or to any nation or any particular race. It belongs to God. And man, whether at the poles or on the equator, has a right to claim it as the property of his Father. On this grounds, he claimed that the truths inculcated by the Western Savior are also property of himself and his countrymen, and thus he established the Samaj of the Brahmos independently of that which was in his own country in the beautiful Bhagavata. His noble deeds will certainly procure him a high position in the history of reformers. But then, to speak the truth, he would have done more if he had commenced his work of reformation from the point where the last reformer of India left it. It is not our business to go further into this subject. You see his whole point about bad critics, you know. Suffice it to say that the Bhagavata did not attract the genius of Ram Mohan Roy. His thought, mighty though it was, unfortunately branched like the Rani Gunj line of the railroad from the barren station of Shankaracharya and did not attempt to be an extension from the Delhi terminus of the great Bhagavata expounder of Nadia. He's bringing in Chaitanya. We do not doubt that the progress of time will correct the error, and by a further extension, the branch line will lose itself somewhere in the major line of progress. We expect these attempts in an abler reformer of the followers of Ram Mohan Roy. The Bhagavata has suffered alike from shallow critics, both Indian and outlandish and foreign. That book has been accursed and denounced by a great number of our young countrymen who have scarcely read its contents and pondered over the philosophy on which it is founded. it is owing mostly to their imbibing an unfounded prejudice against it when they were in school. The Bhagavad, as a matter of course, has been held in derision by those teachers who are generally of an inferior mind and intellect. Remember, he spent time as a school teacher too. This prejudice is not easily shaken when the student grows up unless he candidly studies the book and ruminates on the doctrines of Vaishnavism. We are ourselves witness to the fact. When we were in college, reading the philosophical works of the West and exchanging thoughts with the thinkers of the day, we had a real hatred toward the Bhagavad. That great work looked like a repository of wicked and stupid ideas, scarcely adapted to the 19th century, and we hated to hear any argument in its favor. With us, then, a volume of Channing, Parker, Emerson, or Newman, these are all these American Unitarian philosophers, transcendentalists, and so on. With us then, a volume of Channing, Parker, Emerson, or Newman had more weight than the whole lot of Vaishnava works. Greedily we pored over the various commentaries of the Holy Bible and the labor of the Tattva Bodhini Sabha, containing extracts from the Upanishads and the Vedanta, but no work of the Vaishnavas had any favor with us. But when we advanced in age and our religious sentiment received development, we turned out in a manner Unitarian in our belief and prayed as Jesus prayed in the garden. Accidentally, we fell in with a work about the great Chaitanya, and on reading it with some attention in order to settle the, who means Chaitanya Charitamrita? We fell in with a work about the great Chaitanya, and on reading it with some attention, in order to settle the historical position of that mighty genius of Nadia, we had the opportunity of gathering his explanations of the Bhagavatam, given to the wrangling Vedantas of the Benares school. The accidental study created in us a love for all the works which we find about our Eastern Savior. We gathered with difficulty the famous Karchas in Sanskrit, written by the disciples of Chaitanya. The explanation that we got of the Bhagavata from these sources were of such a charming character that we procured a copy of the Bhagavata complete and studied its text. Difficult, of course, to those who are not trained up in philosophical thoughts, with the assistance of the famous commentaries of Sridhar Swami. From such study it is that we have at least gathered the real doctrines of the Vaishnavas. Oh, what a trouble it is to get rid of the prejudice gathered in unripe years. It's quite wonderful, isn't it? The story. Anyway, it goes on. I'll just skip ahead a little bit. We have 2 minutes. He goes on. What sort of a thing is the Bhagavata? Asked the European gentleman, newly arrived in India. His companion tells him with a serene look that the Bhagavata is a book which his aurea bearer daily reads in the evening to a number of hearers. It contains jargon, a jargon of unintelligible and savage literature of those men who paint their noses with some sort of earth or sandal and wear beads all over their bodies in order to procure salvation for themselves. Another of his companions, who had traveled a little in the interior, would immediately contradict him and say the Bhagavata is a Sanskrit work claimed by a sect of men, the Goswamis, who give mantras like the popes of Italy to the common people of Bengal and pardon their sins on payment of gold enough to defray their social expenses. A third gentleman will repeat, a third explanation young Bengal, chained up in English thoughts and ideas, and wholly ignorant of the pre-Mohammedan history of his own country, will add one more explanation by saying that the Bhagavata is a book containing the life of Krishna, who was an ambitious and an immoral man. That's all he could gather from his grandmother while yet he did not go to school. Thus the great Bhagavata ever remains unknown to foreigners, like the elephant of the six blind men who caught hold of the several parts of the body of the beast. But truth is eternal and is never injured but for a while by ignorance. This was his statement. I'm becoming a devotee. Truth is the group he came from. The Bhagavata. The first thing he did was explain to his westernized intellectual companions, for whoever his immediate audience were in Vishnapur, he was like the thinking of the larger group of the Tagores, and everybody else who had rejected Chaitanya, didn't know about him, thought he was an epileptic or something. So this is addressed to those people. He's wild. You ever read this? Yes, it's very good. But we have to thank Bhagavan Thakur because we're devotees because of him. You see, Satchinanatha Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai.